Too Much Scrolling for June 15th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back again. Unbelievable but true. There's another story about Sherlock Holmes, guys.
Exactly.
Number 42. It's a pretty special day.
42?
Yeah. I'm wearing a plaid sports jacket, Steve.
As you are apt to do, yes.
Of course, because but I didn't see one automobile in this entire story, Steve.
We're not quite to the automobile stories yet. This is the disappearance of Lady Frances Carfax, and if you ever want to know, yes, you should ask for the Carfax.
Check the Carfax.
Check the Carfax.
Are they a sponsor, Steve?
They are now. This episode of Sherlock Holmes brought to you by Carfax. This is a good one, isn't it? This one is not as silly as yesterday's very silly story. It's not quite as dark as some of our dark tales, not quite as international intrigue as some of those. This is a middle of the line mystery, right?
I really like this one. I like the sort of sensational element, and I don't know, I like the tropes that come up in this one. So for example, you know, the opening with a very playful Holmes is super familiar, but I love the openings where Holmes can just guess something about Watson by taking a look. So this one starts in mid-sentence. "But why Turkish?" asked Mr. Sherlock Holmes, gazing fixedly at my boots. Now, we learn here that Watson is feeling a little old and rheumatic, which is why he paid for a Turkish bath. And he both enjoys and does not enjoy Sherlock's little mind-reading tricks. So I feel like as readers, we totally love it when Sherlock Holmes looks at Watson's shoes and figures out he just had a Turkish bath. But, you know, we also understand why Watson might, you know, occasionally get a little irritated at this.
I love this. This is not exactly a cold open. This is certainly jumping into the scene. We are so familiar with this pair at this point that jumping into the scene, but why Turkish, is joyous.
Well, and I do think that Watson's answer also speaks to their closeness. You know, he's feeling a little down. He's approaching middle age. He's got a little rheumatism. You know, he's honest with why he went to a Turkish bath. And, you know, they've been friends for a really long time now.
Holmes introduces the mystery by offering Watson an all-expenses-paid trip to Switzerland. How about that? How about that, Watson? Hey! Just the term all-expenses-paid being in this story was pretty silly.
Best.
Well, yeah, he's like, it's like, let's make a deal. You know, he's won this trip. You just won a trip to Switzerland.
To do some investigative work for me. You're welcome.
He introduces the fact that not for the first time, there is a damsel in distress. Okay, so I want to ask you guys a very serious question. Now, remember with the cardboard box, which we just read a few days ago, I was like a little peevish because Watson was like, oh, you know, women over 40, obviously not in any way related to the love plot. We can put that aside. Now, here he has a woman over 40 who's a little bit different. And there's some quite interesting statements about our titular character, Lady Frances Carfax. So I want to read you guys a couple quotes and get like your opinions on these. So Sherlock says, "One of the most dangerous classes in the world is the drifting and friendless woman. She is the most harmless and often the most useful of mortals, but she is the inevitable inciter of crime in others. She is helpless. She is migratory. She has sufficient means to take her from country to country and from hotel to hotel. She is lost as often as not in a maze of obscure pensions and boarding houses. She is a stray chicken in a world of foxes." I cannot believe I read that without laughing. "When she is gobbled up, she is hardly missed. I much fear that some evil has come to the Lady Frances Carfax."
So I'm going to go ahead and respond to this, Steve.
Chip.
So I'm going to go ahead and say this is a trap. This is a trap. We do not answer this question at all. Listen, I've fallen for this, and I'll never fall for it again.
I gotta say, Pam, when he mentioned 40, I knew that you were going to bring this up, because absolutely in the cardboard box, that was really a big statement that he made, that women over 40 are invisible. Middle-aged huh? women cannot be a part of the love plot of any type. And this seems to be, somebody said something to Doyle and said, you know, you might want to change your opinion on that. And this seems to be the answer to that. I was thinking of you very much when I read this.
Yes, gender analysis moving around. But okay, but isn't it interesting? Like, think about just the very opening of this. One of the most dangerous classes in the world is the drifting and friendless woman. This like unattached woman, you know, presents danger. She's both harmless and the inevitable inciter of crime in others. Interesting, right?
Blaming the victim. It's very...
It's interesting that he suggests, which that laughable line, she is a stray chicken in a world of foxes. Now, okay, that's like a really bad line.
Oh my God.
Right? Don't say that ever to anyone. But it's less interesting that this woman is no longer, like this 40-year-old woman, she is not invisible. She is mm-hmm. not like an object totally beyond any kind of erotic gaze. She's like an object of desire, right? And so that is kind of an interesting move, I think. And as we get the description of Lady Frances specifically, the narration, a rather pathetic figure, the Lady Frances, a beautiful woman, still in fresh middle age, and yet by a strange chance, the last derelict of what only 20 years ago was a goodly fleet. Now, perhaps...
derelict.
to answer nothing on this topic, perhaps. But...
I'm not saying anything. I don't say anything. I'm just,
I appreciate your silence.
And Steve, I agree. I just want to say I agree with...
whatever Pam says. Absolutely.
We'll just have to...
I really think that this is a reconsideration on Doyle's part, that he really got the message from somebody somewhere since the cardboard box that it's okay for a middle-aged woman to actually still be beautiful, to actually be an object of desire. And this woman, okay, he puts in the, she's new to middle age. She's just reached the middle age line, but this is still a beautiful woman.
Mm-hmm. Now, he does
derelict of the fleet okay. that she is.
God,
a terrible word that conjures up so much imagery. Derelict is, oh my goodness.
Right, so what you really need to know is that he is a skilled writer, and he yes. still chose these words. What is that? It's not that he was like I'm just a floundering writer looking for words. No. He is a skilled writer. These words have meaning.
Mm-hmm. And the stray chicken. However, like most lonely ladies, Lady Frances found her comfort and occupation in religion.
Okay, Doyle. You get to both bash religion and middle-aged women in one sentence. Okay, we get it. Thank you.
A lot of repression in that statement, Steve. Oh, boy. A lot of guilt, lots of repression right there.
Okay.
But you guys, here's the thing. So this sort of shift of perspective, right, where Watson and Holmes both understand Lady Frances as a, you know, as potentially still allowed to be part of the love plot, that's really interesting because we go solo Watson here, right? And solo Watson doesn't see what Holmes sees, which is that Lady Frances does in fact have a suitor. And so it becomes super important to the plot of the story, not just to the way that we might read gender relations in any 19th century text, but it becomes actually a point of investigation that Lady Frances is still an object of desire, and that one of the main characters that Watson's chasing around having fistfights with is actually her suitor, not her kidnapper.
So it's a super important time point. Shooter. So before she was derelict, he was
when she was part of the goodly fleet. This young gentleman was oh dear.
Watson goes to Switzerland by himself, and Holmes does not go to quote on general. This is so silly. Quote, on general principles, it is best that I should not leave the country. Scotland Yard feels lonely without me, and it causes an unhealthy excitement among the criminal classes.
Not to put too fine a point, Morton Holmes is.
I'm going to have to figure out some version of that to use around my house. That would be a fun thing to say.
I was thinking about using that for too much scrolling. If I do a solo show, if I interview somebody without you, it just feels so lonely without you, Chip. I mean, it's unhealthy. There's an unhealthy excitement exactly. when you're not here.
Among the podcast guests.
Exactly.
Okay, guys, let me bring you back to the last couple times we've seen Solo Watson. What are you thinking? Solo Watson, what do you got?
I got Ned Beatty from the Superman movie saying Mr. Luthor, and who's going to be playing him. And he's going to bumble his way around because... and then Gene Hackman could play Sherlock Holmes and just give him the look of like, oh my God, how am I surrounded by this?
This is so reminiscent of The Hound of the Baskervilles. This is the same setup for Hound of the Baskervilles. Sherlock says, no, Watson, you go, I can't. I have more important things to do. And right away, because we read Hound of the Baskervilles, I thought, we're going to see Sherlock in like the next two paragraphs. He's going to be there. He's going to be in disguise. I was ready for him.
He's going to be a ninja. He's going to be a ninja running around.
Yep. And then it also reminded me of The Solitary Cyclist, where Holmes was like, oh, you go and hide behind the hedges and watch The Solitary Cyclist. And then when Watson's like, okay, great. I really did a lot of investigating. Let me report to you. He says super proudly. And Holmes is like, oh, not an error was left unturned. So it's really like that same dynamic. So I like the combination. I feel like he's drawing from both Hound and Cyclist. So I love, of course, we're in Watson's perspective. He's feeling great. He knows he is rocking this case. He's doing exactly what Holmes would have done. He finds the maid's lover. He learns of another man on the trail of Lady Frances. He's got a suspect. And I love how the maid's French lover says, "Un sauvage, un véritable sauvage," which, you know, has like that continental feel to it.
She spoke French.
I did get the Watson goes to Switzerland episode here. There was that whole continental feeling to this for sure.
Totally. Right. Then he speaks to the English hotel guy who describes the savage. He is a bulky, bearded, sunburned fellow who looks as if he would be more at home in a farmer's inn than in a fashionable hotel. A hard, fierce man, I should think, and one whom I should be sorry to offend. So here we go. Watson sends Holmes his first telegram and, quote, receives in reply a telegram of half-humorous commendation. I'd love to see that telegram.
Doyle doesn't write that. He doesn't need to. We understand how tongue-in-cheek Sherlock would be in telling Watson how good a job he's doing.
Listen, if he needed a few more words, he could have put it in there, but he doesn't need it. The story's long enough.
What about the second telegram, guys? I love the second telegram.
Yeah, Holmes writes a second telegram and asks about the description of Dr. Schlesinger's left ear. And the quote says, "Holmes's ideas of humor are strange and occasionally offensive, so I took no notice of his ill-timed jest."
Oh, and what Watson. Are we thinking as readers, right?
As readers, I absolutely glommed onto that as a vital clue. I thought Doyle absolutely was telling us that here is a seed for us to very carefully look out for a man with something wrong with his ear.
Well, and we just learned in the cardboard box that Holmes recently wrote two monographs on the distinctions of the human ear. So, I mean, he doesn't, you know, just like randomly make jokes about ears.
Ears are nothing to be joked about, that's for sure.
Noted. Noted from the Hungarian.
Right. Satellite dishes at this point. Watson and the Savage get into a fist fight, and Watson is saved by an unshaven French ouvrier. Is it? Was that close enough, Pam?
It's an ouvrier.
That was not even close then. In a blue blouse. I love when we get this moment where Sherlock is there and he reveals himself with those words, "Well, Watson."
It's so great. And I think that's partly what I love about this story. I think the story is super interesting, but we've got all of those really favorite tropes. We're in story 42. We love these moments and we see it coming, right? Just like you said, Steve, you knew that Holmes wasn't going to be like, sure, check back in a week. He's going to show up in Lausanne. Absolutely. And there he is.
Yeah.
And as he shows up, of course, Holmes gives his usual gentle critique of Watson's work. He says, "And a singular investigation you have made, my dear Watson. I cannot at the moment recall any possible blunder which you have omitted. The total effect of your proceeding has been to give the alarm everywhere and yet to discover nothing."
So totally a Gene Hackman Luthor reference from the Superman 1978 movie as he's talking to Otis, and the incompetence, just recognizing the incompetence. Mm-hmm.
There's no possible blunder that you could have done that you didn't already do. Oh my goodness.
Wow. And we wonder why, you know, Watson doesn't have any self-esteem.
And so, but okay, he does bitterly come back. He says, "Perhaps you would have done no better," he answered bitterly. And Holmes comes back on that. "There is no perhaps about it. I have done better." Oh, geez, Holmes, come on. Throw me a bone here.
You want to take shots at me? I'll just come right back, right? Have you failed again? Let's talk about that.
But you guys, like, what Holmes has done better is recognize that this bearded savage, he's not the kidnapper. He's also looking for Lady Frances, and he is in fact her suitor. And so that's what he recognized. Doyle got the message between stories, and apparently Holmes did too.
And this is Philip Green, who has loved Lady Frances for years and years and years. He has held his love, and she, quote, "loved me well enough to remain single all her sainted days just for my sake alone." That's real devotion in an unrequited love situation. This is a very interesting situation that Doyle has given us here.
So this reminds me of The Adventure of the Abbey Grange, where Captain Crocker has this long, long love for a woman. Remember, he had kissed the deck of the ship where she had stood.
And she stepped on it, so he kissed it.
But you get this feel. No, but like this fierce, brave, super, like uber masculine man who's just has this deep and devoted love for a woman. And you kind of wonder, even though Doyle doesn't mention at the end that Philip Green and Lady Frances might have some, you know, might have a relationship in the future, I kind of wondered, possibly. Yeah.
It's left open for sure. Sure. Here, not only are we in Switzerland, but we also get South America and Australia when we find out that the left ear that Holmes was so worried about is that of the suspect, the Reverend Dr. Schlesinger, the missionary from South America, who is none other than Holy Peters, one of the most unscrupulous rascals that Australia has ever evolved. And for a young country, it has turned out some very finished types.
I love it.
How was Australia populated again?
Exactly.
And he is one of the worst. Oh my goodness. That must say something. There may be some prejudice against the Australians.
I don't know. A little bit here. The Aussies. Oh, you're from Australia, you say. So you're a ruffian. Ah.
An unscrupulous rascal.
Now that's a knife.
His left ear is particularly deformed because he was badly bitten in a saloon fight in 1889.
And so in Australia.
Uh-huh. And somehow Holmes has this knowledge.
So this is what is this? Evander Holyfield? Who was the guy Mike Tyson bit his ear?
Yes. Yes, okay. Precisely. Just like that. So Watson is amazed that ear joke wasn't a joke. That was a real clue. And we're, as readers, we're going, yes, Watson, come on. You know how much Sherlock is into ears. Let's go.
Where was that going to be even noted? I mean, is that in a newspaper?
How would he have his ways?
He's got his ways. That's right. He's got kids running around in Australia, too.
Right. Now, Holy Peters is a pretty terrible guy because his particular specialty is the beguiling of lonely ladies by playing upon their religious feelings, and his so-called wife is an English woman named Fraser. And so this is really, once again, right, the damsel in distress trope is taken quite seriously. This idea of preying on, you know, middle-aged single women, it's a pretty horrific crime, and Watson and Holmes take it really seriously.
So Lady Carfax is in grave danger indeed. The pair have been pawning off her jewels, the jewels that she treasures so much that she won't put them in a bank. She carries them with her everywhere she goes. We've seen this trope so many times. Mm-hmm. I possess this thing and I care for it so much, I wouldn't ever let anybody put it into a safe. I'm going to carry it with me. That's much sure. better.
This important contract, I'm going to carry it to my house, you know, out in the open.
Philip Green followed the Lady Fraser into an undertaker's shop, and she had a coffin delivered to her flat. Uh-huh.
Never a good sign. Yes, and so,
no good.
It's a large trunk. We carry things.
It could be that, but it also has a pretty good symbol of life and death tied to it, huh?
Hmm.
And here we get the kind of moral conundrum we've seen in many, many, many of these cases, although it's a little bit different. So when he finds out about the coffin, Sherlock is like, okay, we have to jump into action. Let's hope that she's not dead yet. She's either dead or they're getting ready to kill her. When you order a coffin, it's not good. So he sends the police to get a warrant. And then in the meantime, Sherlock and Watson go in. And Watson says, we will do all that can be done, Mr. Green. Not a moment will be lost. Leave it in our hands. Now, Watson, he added as our client hurried away, he will set the regular forces on the move. We are, as usual, the irregulars, and we must take our own line of action. And so Holmes asks if Watson is armed. And Watson's like, well, I've got my stick. Well, we shall be strong enough, says Holmes. Thrice is he armed who hath his quarrel just. So, you know what? When you're on the side of justice, you don't need to be super well armed. But then,
I've got a stick.
We don't need no stinking badges.
So when they
right?
Peters, Holy Peters, is like, where's your warrant? Holmes half drew a revolver from his pocket. This will have to serve till a better one comes. Why, you are a common burglar, says Peters. So I really, that was so funny how Holmes is like, do you have your revolver? And Watson's like, oh, I don't. But Holmes does. It's all good.
Right.
Now, the police in Lausanne are fine with Sherlock's fairly sketchy actions. Peters calls the police and is like, this guy is, you know, he's broken into my home. He's got a revolver.
No problem.
Here we are. We're in a foreign land. Somehow they know about Sherlock Holmes. And they pull a gun out on a... everything's cool. I mean, no worries here. We're in the right. Oh, my goodness. This is nuts. This is nuts.
The sergeant tells Holmes, you know what, buddy, you do have to leave. Sorry, Mr. Holmes, but that's the law. Exactly, Sergeant. You could not do otherwise. I expect there was good reasons for your presence there. If there's anything I can do... It's a missing lady, Sergeant, and we think she is in that house. I expect a warrant presently. Then I'll keep my eyes on the parties, Mr. Holmes. If anything comes along, I will surely let you know. So, there we go.
No violation of rights at all there.
Well, and the police and Holmes are really working together.
This is one of those cases where actually there's justice and the law involved instead of one or the other in this one.
Right. And I think we see that more in the later stories, because remember how at the beginning there was always such antipathy between Holmes and the police. And now we've just really, really moved past that. This is like Holmes in his middle years.
Yeah, just getting back to this. I just came into your house, I pulled out a gun, and the police arrive, and we're all cool with that, because, you know, the police said it was okay. And I think this guy, even though he's the bad guy, he's absolutely justified in saying, why is this being allowed in my place?
Oh, rational Chip, and your ideas about rules and laws.
Yeah, I guess the liberty of it is okay until unless you're involved in it, right? Unless you're the person who's a bad guy.
Right.
Oh my God. And if you're not the bad guy, maybe we can make you the bad guy.
But Lord. He's the bad guy. It's okay, Chip.
He is the bad guy. He is the bad guy. We learned that out. And it's stupid. What a crazy way to end this one, too.
Well, it's very sensational, right? And you kind of know, like, as soon as you see, like, the coffin going into the house, you know he's going to be pulling from the sensational Gothic tradition, right? So when they go in, they open the coffin, and there's, like, a little old lady in there. You know, the nurse of his wife. I'm like, oh man. Holmes is like, this is crazy. But sure enough, and then Holmes realizes in the night, right before the 8 a.m. funeral, he's like, wait a minute. That coffin was way too deep. They're going to put Lady Frances in the coffin with the double body. It's like the perfect way to get rid of a body, right? And Holmes realizes that Holy Peters and his wife, they don't, Lady Frances might still be alive. They might not have wanted to actually commit a murder with their hands or with a weapon. And indeed, he's right. So when he yells, guys, open the coffin. And people totally are like, okay, we'll do it, Sherlock. They find that Lady Frances has been chloroformed. So she's not dead. They were going to allow her to die in the coffin.
Oh, and with another dead person in there with her. That's awful.
Isn't that the reason why you bury it and they have the bell set up?
Uh-huh. So,
yeah, just in case.
Just in case we were wrong about the death, yeah.
Yeah. And then they have, and she's described as having a statuesque face of a handsome and spiritual woman of middle age. And so we get that again, that she's still attractive. And as
she's chloroformed.
Despite her decrepitude and her derelict fleet. Yes.
She's looking really good there in her passed out form. Oh my God.
So it was looking pretty dicey for 30 minutes or so, but she does recover. And so...
Later on, they sell the coffin off to a magician, so he's ready for
right?
It's a deeper coffin. We've got a dead body in there, and then a live person comes out later. How do we do that?
With a flourish. That's how we do it. We come to Pam's favorite part, the ending.
Thank you. Well, and I really do like this ending. Because Holmes is really reflecting on how it took him a really long time to process the clue of the coffin being deeper than usual and of it having been a custom coffin for, you know, Holy Peters's wife's elderly nurse. And why would that be? And so in the end, there's a little bit of humility from Holmes, which we don't see super often. He says, "Should you care to add the case to your annals, my dear Watson?" said Holmes that evening. "It can only be as an example of that temporary eclipse to which even the best balanced mind may be exposed. Such slips are common to all mortals, and the greatest is he who can recognize and repair them. Okay, so this is like home-style humility, right? It's like, mm-hmm. you know, the smartest among us can figure out when we've made a mistake. But it is still like acknowledging, hey, Watson, when you write this story up, like put it in the story that I totally made a mistake and it did take me much longer than it should have to figure it out.
Even Albert Einstein can be puzzled
And we've seen this before. He has added that to some stories before where he, Sherlock says, you write this down. You make a record of this. I was puzzled a little more than usual. I figured it out, but I was puzzled a little bit more than usual on this one.
So in my lifetime, we've had times where I've been tripped up for a little while.
Right. And, you know, it's all about accuracy. This is about Sherlock Holmes, the rational man, who's like, it's super important to note our failures as well as our successes. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a good scientist, right? We learn just as much when a science experiment doesn't work as when it does.
Right.
Now, it's interesting because it's quite a lengthy ending, which we won't go through the whole thing. It starts with this sort of note of his failure. It ends in a super interesting way. He says about the body in the coffin, a clever device, Watson. It is new to me in the annals of crime. If our ex-missionary friends escape the clutches of Lestrade, I shall expect to hear of some brilliant incidents in their future career. So he ends by saying, you know, those criminals were pretty smart. Like, that was pretty cool what they did with the double body coffin. And, you know, if they get away, I don't see why they would. We'll see more of those good criminals. It's kind of an interesting close.
Well, that means Doyle is just setting this up so that, you know, he doesn't have to make up the criminals later on. They'll just kind of return over and over and over.
I'm not sure of that.
I'm not sure of that, but it is going to the Sherlock admiration of criminal minds. He enjoys finding his match. He enjoys seeing something that he's never seen before.
Exactly. And likes the competition.
We've seen that over and over again, and this is definitely one of those stories.
Exactly.
This is fun. Have we talked for an hour yet? This is one of those good stories that we talk a lot about, as opposed to the silly stories that we talk a lot about because they're silly, as opposed to the really deep stories that we talk a lot about because they're really deep. This was a lot of conversation about this story. We're still enjoying these stories, aren't we? 42 short stories and two novels in at this point.
What's going to be interesting is when we get to our episode where we kind of discuss all the short stories together from this book, how his writing has matured and changed from those early short stories that he introduced the character.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I do think his Last Bow, it's one of the shorter collections, but there are only 7 or 8 stories in this one. And some of them are pretty weak, but there's some good stories in this as well. And sure. So and yeah, and the variety here is maybe it's as good a variety as I think as we get in any of the collections,
because they're skipping around in different eras of his writing as well.
Yes.
So there's a lot of variety there that way. This is great. I'm glad that we're doing this. I'm glad that everybody out there is listening. Hope you're still listening after all of our silliness. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call or a text, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that feedback from around the world, and go to our dedicated website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all these conversations all in one convenient place. Join us tomorrow as we get into the next story, The Adventure of the Devil's Foot. That sounds interesting. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedar.
Where's my sandwich?
A lot of throat lozenges thrown in this because people are coughing.
Lozenges? Are there?
There's coughing in this story, Steve.
Is there
lozenges in Lausanne?
Is there wizardry? lozenges and wizardry. There's reminiscences.